What you are about to hear is a tapestry of sound woven from the voices of men and women who made history in an era almost beyond recall. Their names have a fuzzy familiarity. William Gladstone, Jim Corbett, Billy Sunday, Rudolph Valentino. And perhaps the sound of their voices, faithfully re-recorded from early phonograph cylinders and discs, can add a new dimension to mere words and pictures. For a few moments, they live again as history speaks. It speaks in the year 1888. The place is London. A steel needle stabs into a wax cylinder and records the faint, feeble voice of the premier poet of the Victorian age. Alfred Lord Tennyson, in his 80th year, recites a poem he dashed off some 34 years earlier after reading a news dispatch from the Crimean War. Of all his great works, he will be remembered longest for the charge of the Light Brigade. He begins. Cannon to the right of them, cannon to the left of them, cannon in front of them, volleyed and thundered.
Cannon to the right, cannon to the left, cannon in front of them, volleyed and thundered. Charge that way, shot and hell, fly horse and hell fell, they that had fought so well, fall through the jaws of gas, past the mouth of hell. Oh, that was left of them, left.
Into the jaws of death rode the 600. This is the 19th century, and Britannia rules the waves. The brave British soldier has fought and died in India, in China, in Abyssinia, in Afghanistan, so that the sun may never set on the British Empire. But the 19th century is almost over, and England is tired of war. Her veteran Prime Minister, William Ewart Gladstone, comments on the new miracle, the phonograph, as follows. As to the future consequences, it is impossible to anticipate them.
As to the future consequences, it is impossible to anticipate them.
All I see is that wonder upon wonders are opening before us.
All I see is that wonder upon wonders are opening before us.
Out of the desolation of the Civil War springs a nation with wealth, ambition, and know-how. The telegraph, the telephone, the phonograph, the electric lamp, the linotype, the motion picture camera. Each emerges from the fertile brain of an American, and each has a tremendous impact on our civilization. But we have no monopoly on genius. In Italy, a 21-year-old electrical engineer ponders the problem of transmitting messages without wires, and in the year 1895, he succeeds in sending a signal across the modest distance of 1 mile. 6 years later, he completes a message across the Atlantic without wires, and the world applauds the marvel of radio and a young man named Guglielmo Marconi.
On December 12, 1901, we're in a haphazard receiving station, rigged up by myself at St. John's, Newfoundland, I was able to receive a succession of three clicks corresponding to the three dots of the letter S launched by a Morse key on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean.
But there is no radio in the wonderful decade we call the gay 90s. A nation relaxes with nickel beer and 25-cent steaks. It sings Sweet Rosie O'Grady and The Sidewalks of New York. It sighs over the hourglass figure and peaches and cream complexion of the Gibson girl. Things just couldn't be better. Everybody is relaxed, even William McKinley, who conducts most of his campaign for the presidency in 1896 from his front porch in Canton, Ohio. His platform is a solid dollar, backed by gold, high protective tariffs, and the annexation of the Hawaiian Islands. America approves, and McKinley becomes the last president in the 19th century.
My fellow citizens, recent events have imposed upon the patriotic people of this country a responsibility and a duty greater than that of any since the Civil War. Then it was a struggle to preserve the government of the United States. Now it is a struggle to preserve the financial honor of the government. It was a contest to save the Union. Now it is a contest to save faultless its credit. Then section was arrayed against section. Now men of all sections can unite and will unite to rebuke the repudiation of our obligations and the debasement of our currents. In this contest, patriotism is above party and national honor is dearer than any party name. The currency and credit of the government are good now and must be kept good forever. Our trouble is not with the character of the money that we have, but with the threat to the basis. We have the same currency that we had in 1892. Good the world over and unquestioned by any people. Soon we had an example of credit and prosperity. Our difficulty now is to get that money in circulation and invested in productive enterprises which furnish employment to American labor.
As the 19th century surrenders to the 20th, a giant of literature sits down before a phonograph to give the world a simple, straightforward philosophy. Count Leo Tolstoy, author of the epic War and Peace, speaks his innermost thoughts. He says, "In the same way, we now have some who do not pay heed to the instructions for the guidance of our life.
In this same way, they have in our world those who do not pay heed to the instructions for the guidance of our life.
Written in our heart and in all the great teaching of the wisest of mankind.
Written in our heart and in all the great teachings of the wisest of mankind.
There are armies on the march as the new century dawns, and one of them is an army the likes of which the world has never seen. It has iron discipline, immaculate uniforms, and brass bands, but it has no guns. Its only weapon is the Bible. The Salvation Army makes its peaceful invasion from England and establishes its beachheads in the slums of America's cities. General William Booth, founder of the Salvation Army, reveals the dedication of his cause.
Dear comrade, look up to the joys set before thee, and haste on thy way to the regions of glory. A crown and a kingdom thy fate may discover. Thy troubles are great, but they soon will be over. For Jesus hath suffered thy soul to deliver, and open thy passage through Jordan's dark river. Christ is a sure help to the children of Zion. But if thou hast only false props to rely on, thy soul is deluded. Think what thou art doing. Oh, cast them away, ere they bring thee to ruin.
In Rome, the phonograph enters the Vatican for the first time and records the voice of a great man of God, Pope Leo XIII. The beloved leader of the Catholic world is 93 years old as he chants the Ave Maria shortly before his death in 1903.
Maria, gratia plena, Dominus tecum, benedicta tu in mulieribus, et benedictus fructus ventris tui Iesus. Santa Maria, Mater Dei, ora pro nobis,
great social movements are making their first hesitant debuts, feeling the climate of public opinion and the pulse of public conscience. Their credo is unselfishness, of goodwill for mankind. In England, Sir Robert Baden-Powell, a distinguished veteran of the Boer War, has a novel idea. Why not train young people for life in much the same way an army would train them for war? He starts an organization where boys wear uniforms, are given special badges for physical achievement, and are encouraged to be of service to others. He calls it the Boy Scouts, and within a few years the Boy Scout movement has spread to America and all over the world. Many years later, Sir Robert looks back at the vast organization he began.
The danger lies in the people becoming accustomed to having their minds made up for them, without any exercise of their own judgment or conscience in the process. We train the boy to balance his mind by discussions and mock trials, whereby he gets the habit of hearing both sides of a question before making up his mind on a subject. Thus, the fervid eloquence of the tub-thumper leaves him cold, and he is not carried away by it. Our aim is to build up a sane and balanced manhood to counter the misleading propaganda now becoming so prevalent, and to meet the extension of franchise now open to thousands of young men and young women.
The North Pole, the mysterious top of the world, captures the imagination of man in the early years of the new century. Why would anyone want to risk his life to stick a little flag into a piece of ice that looks no different from hundreds of miles of ice around it? Because nobody has ever done it before. That's why. For 1,000 years, the North Pole has resisted discovery, while fearless and occasionally foolhardy men inched ever closer. And now, suddenly, one of them reaches the goal. But which one? We have 2 claimants, both with convincing stories to tell. The first is Dr. Frederick Cook.
On April 21st, 1908, I reached the North Pole and unfurled the stars and stripes. At the pole, 2 days were spent to complete the observations. We were glad to get there, glad to be the first to raise the flag on the northern axis. But we found nothing very wonderful, only a shifting desert of frost drifting with the prevailing wind. No life, no land. We were the only pulsating creatures in a dead world of ice.
Geographers listen to Dr. Cook, and their opinions are divided. Some say yes, some say no, some say maybe. A year later, another explorer appears. Not only has he reached the prize objective of 90 degrees north latitude, but he says he nailed the stars and stripes to the pole. His name is Commander Robert E. Peary, and a few skeptics are ignored and drowned out in the public's adulation.
A little less than 400 years ago, in 1527, England sent out the first recorded expedition in search of the North Pole. 80 years later, in 1607, Henry Hudson made his historic voyage. From that time on, for 275 years, Great Britain held the record, slowly pushing the reading up to 83 degrees 20 minutes north latitude. Then, in 1882, the lead came to the United States. 13 years later, Norway went to the front. And in 1900, a member of the Royal House of Italy, the Duke of the Abruzzi, grasped the blue ribbon. 6 years later, the United States took the lead again with a record of 87 degrees 6 minutes. So matters stood in the spring of 1908, when the Periarchic Club of New York City was fitting out its last North Polar expedition. The avowed object which this club placed before itself was the attainment of the North Pole for the prestige and honor of the United States of America. The work divided itself into 2 parts. First, the driving of a specially constructed ship to a point within striking distance of the pole, and then the projection of a sledge party from the ship across the ice of the polar sea to the pole itself. The key of the problem was the negotiation of the 413 miles of icy chaos extending from Cape Columbia, the northernmost point of all North American lands, to the pole. The expedition left New York on the 6th of July, 1908, in the steamer Roosevelt, built by the club and commanded by Captain Robert A. Bartlett, was reviewed by President Roosevelt, and steamed northward, arriving at Cape York, North Greenland, the 1st of August. Eskimos, dogs, furs, and so forth were obtained in the Eskimo country, and on the 18th of August, the Roosevelt steamed north through the narrow, ice-encumbered channels forming the American gateway to the pole. Winter quarters at Cape Sheridan on the north coast of Grant Land, 450 miles from the pole, were reached September 5th. Here, the expedition wintered, hunting, making equipment, and transporting supplies westward to Cape Columbia. The first division of the Northern Sledge Party left the Roosevelt February 15, 1909, the last division February 22nd. The entire sledge party left Cape Columbia heading due north March 1st. The expedition comprising 24 men, 19 sledges, 133 dogs. 4 successive supporting parties in command of McMillan, Borup, Marvin, and Bartlett returned at various intervals, the last in command of Bartlett from the 88th parallel. The main party under my command, 6 men, 5 sledges, 40 dogs, pushed forward by forced marches to the pole itself, where it arrived the 6th of April, 1909. Here, in the midst of great fields of heavy ice, covering an ocean 2 miles or more in depth, with the sun circling round the sky day after day without setting, the stars and stripes were planted, and the record left with a piece of the flag. Returning, we left the pole April 7th, and after a series of forced marches, regained Cape Columbia the 23rd of April, and the Roosevelt the 27th. July 18th, the Roosevelt started south, and September 5th, reached the wireless station at Indian Harbor, Labrador, from whence the message, Stars and Stripes Nailed to the North Pole, was sent flashing over the world. The discovery of the North Pole stands for the inevitable victory of courage, persistence, experience over all obstacles. In the discovery of the North Pole is written the final chapter of the last of the great geographical stories of the Western Hemisphere, which began with the discovery of the New World by Columbus. Here is the cap and climax, the finish, the closing of the book on 400 years of history. The discovery of the North Pole on the 6th of April, 1909, by the last expedition of the Peary Arctic Club, means that the splendid frozen jewel of the North, for which through centuries men of every nation have struggled and suffered and died, is won at last, and is to be worn forever by the Stars and Stripes.
Peary, and not Dr. Cook, becomes another hero in an age of hero worship. But you don't have to discover the North Pole to become an idol, for this is also the golden age of the American athlete. The song of the day is Take Me Out to the Ball Game, and the fans take their sports seriously. They're still buzzing about the 1908 season, when Christy Mathewson won 37 games for the Giants, only to lose the big playoff game for the pennant to the Cubs after poor Fred Merkel had pulled the bonehead play of the century and forgot to touch second base on the last day of the season. The Cubs went on to trounce the Detroit Tigers from the upstart New American League in the World Series. But the Tigers have a young fellow worth watching. His name is Ty Cobb. Boxing, under the Marquess of Queensberry rules, is enjoying a tremendous popularity, and one of its glowing figures is Gentleman Jim Corbett, the man who licked John L. Sullivan.
When I was 17 years old, I was the amateur heavyweight champion of the Pacific Coast. And 9 years after that, I won the heavyweight championship of the world. And it only shows what a boy can do when he just takes care of himself.
It's an age of heroes and heroines. From Paris comes an actress who captures America with her beauty and dramatic flair. She is Sarah Bernhardt, the divine Sarah. And although she speaks in French, it is her emotion that draws tears from her audiences as she plays her accustomed role, the woman betrayed.
Le souffle murmure imperceptiblement cette jeune victime autour du vieux charmant. C'est l'âme d'un zéphyr dont je connais l'histoire pour l'avoir déchiffré un jour dans un trottoir.
Bernhardt is for the sophisticated. The toast of the music halls is the incomparable Diamond Lil. The admirers of Lillian Russell shower her with jewels, cover her with roses, fill her slipper with champagne, and praise her as the most beautiful woman in the world. But what does she do, you ask? Why, she sings.
Oh,
Well, you can't have everything. A shot rings out in Serbia, and the heir to the throne of Austria is dead. Just another Balkan assassination, we say, but we feel sorry for old Franz Joseph, who has already lost his only son in the tragic suicide pact of Meierling. Austria sends a sharp ultimatum to Serbia. So what? They deserve it. Austria declares war on Serbia. Old stuff. It'll blow over in a few weeks. But it doesn't blow over. Suddenly, like a dam bursting, war floods over Europe. Germany declares war on Russia, France, and Belgium. England declares war on Germany. Austria declares war on Russia. Turkey, Italy, and Japan join in. And the war fever even hits places like tiny Montenegro and tinier San Marino. It is a sorrowing Franz Joseph, the last of the world's great emperors, who speaks to the widows and children of his fallen soldiers just before his death in 1916 at the age of 86. So that you may understand his thoughts, we translate from the original German. I extend to the undertaking of the Military Aid Society my warmest wishes. May their efforts on behalf of the widows and orphans of my gallant soldiers be crowned with full success. It can't happen here, we say, but it does. The pressures build up, and in March 1917, three unarmed American ships are torpedoed without warning by German submarines in the space of 48 hours. 3 weeks later, we are at war. The nation stops singing, "I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier," and starts marching to "Over There." The American Expeditionary Force sails for Europe, and General John J. Pershing sends back a message to America from the battlefields of France.
3,000 miles from home, an American army is fighting for you. Everything you hold worthwhile is at stake. Only the hardest blows can win against the enemy we are fighting. Invoking the spirit of our forefathers, the Army asks your unflinching support to the end that the high ideals for which America stands may endure upon the earth.
And we won't be back till it's over there. Finally, it is over. The boys come marching home, and we're in the 20s, the era of wonderful nonsense. It's an era of changing tastes. Ragtime gives way to jazz. The corner saloon, with its family entrance, is replaced by the speakeasy. Cigars are out. Nobody calls you a sissy anymore if you smoke cigarettes. A nation works hard and plays harder. F. Scott Fitzgerald writes that, quote, "The rhythm of the weekend, with its birth, its planned gaieties, and its announced end, followed the rhythm of life, and was a substitute for it," end quote. Here and there, you can still find a link with older and simpler days. Edward H. Southern, one of our finest Shakespearean actors, is 63 years old as he records this excerpt from the classic Seven Ages of Man, from As You Like It.
All the world plays, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances, and one man in his time plays many parts.
And then the lover, sighing like a furnace, with a woeful ballad made to his mistress' eyebrow. What better description of the man who made the hearts of millions of American women flutter as he came bursting at them from the motion picture screen? Rudolph Valentino, the first and greatest of the movie matinee idols, sings a romantic ballad.
El torero de Mestre Mio, el más castizo de San Madrid. En caleta, pidiendo guerra, que al morario me estremecí. Y Gallo Barlova, del Casa, che mue garboso, tirami, tira la capa con questa altiva, il resto brianno se me di fatti.
What tableau of the 20s can be complete without Lucky Lindy? No single achievement ever catapulted a man to fame and fortune so quickly and completely as the epic feat of Charles Lindbergh, who flew a frail monoplane from New York to Paris, exactly 3,605 miles, in 33 hours, 29 minutes, and 30 seconds. The year is 1927, only a generation removed from the Wright brothers at Kitty Hawk. But the age of aviation has arrived. Lindy comes home to a wildly celebrating nation, and President Calvin Coolidge expresses the gratitude felt by millions as he presents the Distinguished Flying Cross to a shy young hero.
It is our great privilege to welcome back to his native land, on behalf of his own people, who have a deep affection for him and have been thrilled by his splendid achievement, a colonel of the United States Officers Reserve Corps. An illustrious citizen of our republic. A conqueror of the air and strengthener of the ties which bind us to our sister nations across the sea. And as President of the United States, I bestow the Distinguished Flying Cross as a symbol of appreciation for what he is and what he has done upon Colonel Charles A. Lindbergh.
On the evening of the 21st of May last, I arrived in the Bourget, Paris. During the week I spent in France, the day in Belgium, and the short period in London and England, the people requested that I bring back to the people of America one message. You have seen the affection of the people of France for the people of America demonstrated to you. Well, thank you.
The last pigeon released from the White House grounds flutters out of sight, and the page of history turns. The era of wonderful nonsense is almost over. It can't go on forever, even though we try hard. We want two chickens in every pot, two cars in every garage. The stock market obliges by zooming steadily upward. People don't know what stock they're buying, but what's the difference? They all make money, don't they? Put it on the margin, and I'll pay the rest when I sell, at a handsome profit, of course. And suddenly, on a peaceful day in October 1929, the market can absorb no more. It stops to catch its breath, and the panic begins. Sell, sell, sell is the cry from every side, and prices go tumbling, down and down, until there doesn't seem to be a bottom. Millionaires read the tale of the ticker and turn away as paupers. There is chaos on Wall Street, and the Great Depression begins. It's all like a bad dream. The trappings of the 20s seem foolish to us now, and we cast them aside in a search for something new and meaningful. The nation takes a hard look at Prohibition, the noble experiment, and declares it a failure. But there are strong voices that fight repeal down to the bitter end. In the case of evangelist Billy Sunday, the bitter end means hands, feet, teeth, and, if necessary, bare gums.
The return of the saloon would mean the overthrow of civilization in our land. It was because I didn't want our boys to die drunkards that I fought and fight. I'm going to live long enough to see America so dry you have to prime a man before it can spit. And I'll fight the saloon from Hawaii to Hoboken. And I'll take it as long as I've got a foot, and I'll fight it and punch it as long as I have a fist. I'll butt it as long as I have a head. I'll bite it as long as I have a tooth, and when I'm old and fistless and footless and toothless, I'll gum it till I go home to glory and it goes home to perdition.
Slowly, ever so slowly, we begin moving forward on the path to a newer, more permanent prosperity. The old voices fade away, and newer voices take their places. The line between history and just yesterday dims, and soon there is nothing left but a few words, a few pictures, and perhaps an old phonograph cylinder to remind those who would look and listen. Let the past speak just one more time in the voice of author Rudyard Kipling.
We know that when all the men who do things have done them, and after all the men who say things about those doings have said them, it is only words, nothing but words that live to show the present how men worked and thought in the past.
It is words, nothing but words, that live to show the present how men worked and thought in the past. Some of the words are still important. Others have long since lost any real meaning. All are there for the world to hear today, tomorrow, forever.